people's marriage, if they are gay and they are married, that their marriage is no less, is no more inferior or less, is worth less than my marriage as a heterosexual.
Other prominent examples of Muslim politicians abandoning Islamic norms include American Senator Ilhan Omar and British London Mayor Sadiq Khan, both of whom have been condemned by traditionalist Muslims for their pro-LGBT stances, among other controversial positions, including support for Israel and the Western war machine.
My name is Sadiq Khan. And now more so than ever before, I say it's with great pride, I am the Mayor of London!
Some argue that compromising is a necessary evil in order to gain Muslims political representation. However, Muslims in high office rarely ever champion issues of concern to the community, particularly Islamic positions, which are considered controversial according to Western worldviews. The issue can be so divisive between Muslims that some scholars now condone the opinion that Muslims should not engage in the democratic process of disbelieving nations. But the debate rages on.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Muslims in public life, we have Lubaba Khalid, who is currently a Young Labour BME officer and previously was the Vice President of Welfare at the University of Westminster Student Union. Her work has centred on the attainment gap, decolonialisation of the university and anti-racism work. Lubaba, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Now, just tell me, what do you make of this story coming out of Scotland? It's obviously a difficult situation that Hamza Yusuf has been put in. It seems as if he's being focused on specifically because of his Muslim background.
That's the reality, because, you know, he's running against another candidate who is a very strong Christian. I've now forgotten her name. What's her name?
Forbes,
yeah. You know, and she's a strong Christian, and she was the same questions around, you know, gay sex and things like that. And she didn't get the same backlash as Hamza Yusuf. So one can only think that, can only come to the conclusion that the backlash that he's getting and the question that he's come is inherently from an Islamophobic position, than it being about the politics that he's running on and the policies that he would like to see if elected.
It seems as if Muslims are in this rock and a hard place. They're kind of stuck where if they choose to stand by traditionalist Islamic interpretations, the kind of thing they would have been brought up to believe, then, of course, they'll become potentially persecuted. They won't be able to pursue mainstream careers, for example, like Hamza Yusuf. If he took a different position on this subject, I doubt he would have been treated so well. Even though he took a pro-Western viewpoint on this issue, he's still being grilled by the media. But I think with Forbes, the Christian alternative, she has taken some controversial positions as well from a mainstream position, but because, you know, she's white British, she's perhaps given the freedom to be controversial without this kind of like, well, her career's going to be completely destroyed as a result of that. Just tell me, as someone, as a Muslim yourself in this country who's, you know, getting involved in politics now, what's the atmosphere like for Muslims in the political sphere right now?
It's very hostile. It's hostile. It is a struggle to find the balance where we're not compromising our morals and our religion, but also wanting to create that change in society and things like that. So it is really tough. A lot of Muslim politicians that may have started off with the right politics and the right reasons and the right morals and things like that for now have been forced to accept these ideas that do contradict our religion. And we shouldn't be somewhat scared to say that. It is written in our scriptures. It is written. These things are not acceptable in Islam. But we're now in a situation where we're being forced to. But then the reality is this is not accepted in the three Abrahamic faiths as well. And I think people do forget that as well. So
it seems like, because this is obviously a secular country by and large, I think, you know, to describe as a Christian country right now is quite rich.
Yeah.
It's hard to find someone who identifies as a Christian these days.
Yeah.
So it seems as if there might be some kind of attack on religion. You mentioned quite rightly that this is a view that all the Abrahamic religions adhere to. It's not just Islam, but it seems as if anyone who is religious and pursues a public career, they can be demonized just for having those opinions, just for, I mean, just for believing in their religion and standing by those principles, they can be demonized. Do you think that that's the case?
I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's what we're really, I think that's where we are right now in terms of, yes, it might be something that's in within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So,
well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA Party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party. Let's see what she had to say.
Humza Yousaf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician. Whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this. I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position, non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages, has earned her a lot of respect, because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Humza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that we're Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Slamikam. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm at Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have a... I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. If we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of which of a party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, this is, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands. She's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise from one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So in context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it. Personally, I don't think we do, not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people, and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then, in that case, that there is an issue here? Because, as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being in... What's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form, and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation? Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views. And then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually, and again, this is, I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick and choose for a lot of Muslims. like, understand me, and, you know, one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
For sure. I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Rebaba, for appearing with us. And thank you to everyone at home for watching as well. This is another edition of Eye on Islam that successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, assalamu alaikum.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question, and that question is about taqiyya. As you know, taqiyya is one of those things which is a subject of contention amongst Muslims, amongst the various madhahib and Muslim sects. Some, such as the madhab of the Ahlul Bayt, the followers of the family of the Prophet, they consider taqiyya to be lawful and permissible in certain places. Taqiyya means, obviously, that we hide our faith in times where we fear for our life, for our wealth, our property, and also our honor. Whereas some other madhahib within Islam, they do not accept this as being permissible. The question we want to ask today is, what are the limits of taqiyya exactly, right? Meaning, where is the point at which taqiyya no longer becomes permissible? Like, for example, let's say that somebody, says that I'm going to burn down this, I'm gonna burn down this mosque, if you're a Muslim or something, right? Are we allowed here to do taqiyya or what, So, fortunately, the answer to this question, we have answers to this question. And in the hadith, many hadiths have been transmitted regarding this subject. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, dissimulation, meaning taqiyya, was established to withhold blood from being shed, meaning Allah Ta'ala, He allowed us to do taqiyya so we can protect our lives so that we don't die, so blood would not be shed. So if dissimulation extends to bloodshed, then there is no dissimulation. What if by doing taqiyya, more blood would be shed than if we didn't do taqiyya, But obviously, in this case, you know, logic dictates that we should avoid it. In continuation, the Imam said, "By Allah, if you are called to aid us, you would say, 'We will not, rather we will dissimulate.'" For example, if somebody says, I'm going to kill this very important person, right? You know, in this situation, would you do taqiyya? No, you wouldn't. Because the life of that person is obviously more valuable than yours. Then dissimulation would be more beloved to you than your fathers and mothers. And if the awaited savior was to appear, meaning the 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, if he was to appear, he would not need to ask you for it, and he would uphold the penalty of Allah among those of you who are hypocrites. So when we keep the logic and the wisdom behind which the, and because of which taqiyya was actually formulated, we can understand also as a corollary its limits and where and to what extent it can be applied and acted upon. We understand that it can only, you know, only be used when it doesn't lead to more problems than it was trying to resolve. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the limits and statutes of taqiyya and dissimulation. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to political commentators, bilateral relationship between the United States and China has been set towards further deterioration as competition between the two major world powers continues with no end in sight. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. According to internal documents, a senior U.S. Air Force commander warned his subordinates that they should brace for war with China over Taiwan in just 2 years' time. In a memo obtained by the outlet and confirmed by U.S. officials, General Mike Minahan, the head of the Air Mobility Command, claimed that as both the United States and Taiwan will be distracted by their presidential elections in 2024, Beijing will be able to make a move against the self-governed island. The memo said, "I hope I'm wrong. My gut feeling tells me we will fight in 2025. The document is referred to all-wing commanders in Air Mobility Command and other Air Force operational commanders and orders them to report on all major efforts related to a potential standoff with China within 1 month. During the month of February, General Mike Minahan directs all NC personnel to fire a clip into a 7-meter target with a full understanding that unrepentant lethality matters most. Aim for the head. He also orders all personnel to update their records and emergency contacts. US commanders are also urged not to shy away from risk during drills. General Mike Minahan wrote, "If you are comfortable in your approach to training, then you are not taking enough risks." While an AMC spokesperson confirmed the authenticity of the memo, an unnamed Pentagon official told NBC News that these comments are not representative of the department's views on China. Senior U.S. officials have claimed in recent months that they have evidence China is rapidly accelerating its timeline for taking control of Taiwan. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all countries in the world recognize that sovereignty, meaning that they would not establish diplomatic contact with Taiwan's secessionist government. The United States, too, claims commitment to that principle, but in violation of its own stated policy and an attempt to antagonize Beijing, Washington has quartered the secessionist government in Taipei, supporting its anti-China stance and supplying it with large cash and weaponry. Tensions over the self-rule island intensified following a provocative visit there last August by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House of Representatives at the time. It prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing says the issue of Chinese Taipei is a red line that must not be crossed. In October, China's President Xi Jinping stated that although Beijing seeks peaceful reunification with Taiwan, it will never promise to give up the use of force and reserves the option to take all necessary measures to achieve this goal. The Fox News Channel has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul has said that with the Democratic President Joe Biden in the White House, the risk of a conflict between China and Taiwan is very high. Congressman Michael McCaul added that the U.S. military is not ready to fight a war with China, and it could run out of precision missiles and advanced technology in less than a week if war breaks out. Congressman Michael McCaul said on Sunday, 29th of January, "We have to be prepared for this, and it could happen, I think, as long as Joe Biden is in office, projecting weakness as he did with Afghanistan that led to Russia to start its special operation in Ukraine, that the odds are very high we could see a conflict with China and Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific." Michael McCaul also said the U.S. could run out of advanced weaponry in less than a week if the United States launched a war with China. A study published by a think tank last week found that the United States would likely run out of some of its munitions, including long-range precision-guided ones, in less than a week if war breaks out with China. The Center for Strategic and International Studies study said that the United States was not adequately prepared for a war with China. The think tank said in its report, "The U.S. defense industrial base is not adequately prepared for the competitive security environment that now exists. It is currently operating at a tempo better suited to a peacetime environment." According to the report, the U.S. military aid to Ukraine has depleted the arms stockpiles of the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and points to the difficulties the United States industrial base could face in supplying munitions for a major war. Michael McCaul lamented, "Our industrial defense base is broken. I signed off on all foreign military weapons sales 3 years ago. They have yet to go into Taiwan. We need that deterrence, but if we don't have the weapons, that's as critical for deterrence." Washington is Taiwan's most important international backer and arms supplier, despite the absence of formal diplomatic relations. US arms sales to Taiwan are a constant irritant to Beijing's relations with Washington, which have rapidly deteriorated in recent years. The Washington Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The newly elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, plans to travel to Chinese Taipei in what would renew tensions with China. Media reports say recently the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, was preparing for Kevin McCarthy's visit to Taipei this spring. If McCarthy goes on to travel to Taipei, it would be the second trip to the self-ruled island by U.S. House Speaker in less than a year, sparking almost back-to-back escalation with China, which has sovereignty over Taipei. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in August of last year, bypassing Beijing diplomatically and establishing direct contact with Taipei to plan the trip. That visit angered China, which issued statements critical of Nancy Pelosi and the U.S. and staged large military exercises in waters near the island to assert its sovereignty. Tensions in the Taiwan Strait reached levels not seen in three decades, with live fire drills in several areas around the island. Kevin McCarthy's possible visit could also waste any gains from a meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 summit last November, which was intended to pave the way for improved relations between the two nations after Nancy Pelosi's visit. International relations analysts with Eurasia Group told media that news of Kevin McCarthy's visit to Chinese Taipei was no surprise because the new House Speaker would want to maintain domestic political legitimacy in the face of bipartisan support for aggressive policy towards China. While the Biden administration had reservations about Nancy Pelosi's trip before it took place, the administration ultimately decided against forestalling it. However, analysts at the Eurasia Group agreed that a second official visit by a U.S. House Speaker does represent an escalation of what Beijing sees as U.S. interference in cross-strait affairs, even though Kevin McCarthy, a Republican, may not be seen as representing official White House policy.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The listeners, Professor Nakavi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, and we have had this pleasure to have him in the studio. We, in this program, discuss your problems, questions related to the Islamic upbringing and different topics which have a very great deal with the Islamic upbringing of children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his family, may peace be upon them. Professor Nakavi, we have been discussing problems with the pampering child. So if a child is pampered much And now we discuss what kind of problems he faces in the family himself. But now when he is having his own family tomorrow, if a child is pampered so much, now he has a wife who does not pamper him much as much he was pampered by his mother. So does this conflict between the two partners arise again now because of the extreme pampering of mother?
Of course, there would be naturally some problems if he has not learned to be behave himself, or maybe not realize the fact that now that age has gone and now he has to take care of his family and his children and his wife in the beginning. So he should be able to understand the fact that he now needs to change his behavior. He needs to change himself as a father, as a husband. And it can be the other way around also. So the wife should also realize that now, after becoming engaged and after the consummation of this marriage, it needs to be developed in a positive way. And everyone, both of them are responsible for it.
Yeah,
you can't.
Because once you become a responsible person, then you have the first things that come right away is the saving money. And if a child is pampered so much, he, as a result, when he develops into an adult, he fails to save money. He fails to fulfill responsibilities. He fails to. He has now the inability to work hard.
Even if he works, then whatever he earns, he may lose it by just using it inappropriately and not using it properly and not taking care of the expenses, not taking care of the savings that have to be done for the future of the family or whatever. So we need to, I mean, before we get into, the important thing is that, of course, before you get into that relationship of husband and wife, we need to know each other before that.
Mm-hmm.
If a person has been pampered to that extent that he's not going to be manage his daily affairs, then you should be on the lookout. You should be careful before getting engaged with such a person.
Right.
So if he has become a person who is not a sane person in his behavior,
mm-hmm.
he's an imbecile and he can't make the proper decisions, then you shouldn't be going into that relationship with such a person. Of course, the problem comes when people are brought together in arranged marriages, and there we need to, things are not taken care of, especially in households and in families where there's an abundance of wealth and extravagance. Rarely do children become accustomed to working hard. So we have family problems and divorces in those families much more than the other families maybe.
All right.
You hear about divorces taking place multiple times. So unfortunately, this pampering normally happens in wealthy households and families. But even then, it can happen in other
families as well, because there are some parents who would actually definitely literally kill themselves to fulfill the demands of their children.
There should be introspection. I mean, there should maybe some problem with their own their upbringing. They had problems. They had, for example, they had felt empty about something. They felt the need to be pampered. Maybe they felt the need for love. They had a lack of love from their parents. They did not feel. They did not get what they wanted, the affection from their parents. Now they want to, you know, compensate for that with their own children. And the behavior that they had expected from their parents,
all right,
may now they were not getting it properly.
All right.
They now want to, you know, somehow
compensate it
and say, look, I should not behave with my children in the way that maybe my parents behaved with me. Now that's problematic.
Exactly. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing about the problems of a pampered child. Over-pampering has always resulted into so many problems, like a child becoming irresponsible, or as an adult having unnecessary demands from different relations. Professor, we discussed what kind of problems he can develop within his family, what kind of problems this child when he grows up can develop when he is married, and now what are the problems when he has unnecessary demands from the society? Don't you think a pampered child also unnecessarily expects more from society?
Yes, of course. He becomes one of the things which happens is he becomes irritated very, very quickly. His demands need to be taken care of. He has to, you know, he expects
people
to. He has
been used to.
He becomes used to things that things should be done upon his demand. He should be.
And that too right away.
Right away. And that is not possible. I mean, when you even.
Maybe that someone can do that in your family, but not in the society. Yes, society is different.
True. So you need to realize the fact that when you come into the society, society is not going to treat you as you were treated by your parents. Maybe the society will not take care of you as your parents did. So the parents, when they bring up their children, they should realize that we are training them for coming into society, for living and dealing with people in society. So they should be taught how to face hardships. I mean, pampering children, giving them the comforts of life is not a good thing all the time. Yes, you need to put them to tests. You need to put them to hard work. You need them to work at home. You need to make them work outside. I mean, as I said, even if you give them pocket money, they should labor for it. They should earn it. They should work for it. So pocket money or any other rewards that we are giving them, anything which we are offering them as gifts and prizes, there should be some conditions, terms to it, so they learn to live with those terms and conditions, and they learn to manage those things when they come into their lives, in the families they bring. They need to come up with themselves as parents,
they grow up.
As families of their own, or the society at large, at the place of work.
Yeah.
Even when they're going to school and college, they can't bully people around. Many people who are over-pampered, they become bullies.
Yeah.
And they bully people around, and they expect all of their peers to bow down to them and to expect them to become, you know.
And we have seen that ragging, those who are raggers in the colleges and the schools, these are especially from the wealthy families, and because their demands have always been fulfilled by their parents right away. So one of the things gets very clear over here, that fulfilling demand of a child is okay, but fulfilling that right away is also not correct.
Reasonable demands important, and giving them some space, allowing them to feel the fact that if they are being their demands are being accepted, they need to offer something in return.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be just one-way traffic. It should be both ways.
Both ways. All right. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing problems of an over-pampered child. So one of the other problems that comes to my mind is that we should learn to say no to them and teach them to accept it. Because when a child is over-pampered, he does not accept no very easily from the society especially, and from different relations other than his very immediate family.
Yes, exactly. As no, as you said, we should learn to say no ourselves.
So it's our problem. We are not able to say no.
Yes.
And that's why we can't say no. He's not ready to listen
to me.
I mean,
that's a general, that could be a general problem, not just in dealing with children, dealing with anyone. We have problems because we, as we said, we need to manage things which are more important in our lives also. We need to be able to say no to things which are lesser of a lesser importance. But that is, again, one of the ways how things needed. We need to learn ourselves and then be able to say no to our children and make them learn to say no. And make
teach them to say no.
Make them learn and teach them to say no and to be able to
accept
being
that.
Said no to them also, both things.
Okay.
They should learn to say no to others where something is not important. Because in life you have things which are important and urgent. You need to take care of
but
things.
But sometimes the same kids become victims just because they are not able to say no. Most of the people, especially girls, I must say that, they become victims of many, many different things, sometimes even bad things, sometimes even being harassed, just because they are not able to say a simple no. And although their entire soul is saying no, but just they are not able to express it verbally, how much they are themselves into the trouble just because of this one thing which is not taught to them properly.
So yes, exactly. Why is it a problem? We are not able to learn to say no? Sometimes we feel sympathy for someone. We can't make him feel offended by saying no. We feel that if we say no to him, he will
offended.
He will feel offended, or he will feel bad about it, or she will feel bad about it. And I don't want to make that person feel bad about me, but I must balance that. I want to see things.
So shall I actually make a scale that I have to always think, my Allah should not feel bad about it. I don't care about other people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What is important for me in life is that the most important thing is I should not be saying yes to things which Allah makes Allah offended. That is very important.
Okay.
And important.
Because there are some things when you say yes to someone and Allah says no to this, and you're saying yes just because the person does not get offended, what we have to teach our children to be careful of is that Allah should not be offended.
True, very true. But again, boils down to this fact that what is important for me is yes, and what is not important for me is no. What is important for me is something which makes me move towards Allah Almighty. Now, it may be something that I do for someone else. Here again, yes, I would say yes and not no, because I'm trying to help him out. Maybe taking care of something which he can't do. Helping him to do something which he, because one of the important things in life is to be able to take care of the needs of other people, and to relieve them of their problems. But then we have to balance between what we want to achieve and what we can make others achieve, and what is important to us. If it is important for us that we need to provide services to others, then say yes. But if it's going to stop me doing other responsibilities which are more important, especially to my own family, then I should say no.
All right. So what we learn over here is that saying no and accepting no from the society, both are extremely important, which are to be taught to our children at a very early age. The earlier you teach them, the more it's easy for you to deal with such children. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming. Thank you so much to your listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520
to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.